You can also subscribe to our podcast or find streaming audio on the audio archive, which is also on the website. Before we begin, I'd like to mention just a couple of other programs that are coming up in the next couple of weeks for your information. Next Wednesday, the 10th of May, the Council will host Dr. Shireen Ebadi, who was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2003 for her efforts to promote human rights in Iran. Her talk is entitled Iran Awakening, Human Rights, Islam, and the West, and it will take place at noon next Wednesday at UC Berkeley in Dwinnell Hall. On Tuesday, May 16th, we'll host Alvin Toffler, author of Future Shock and the Third Wave, and he joins us for a program for his new book, America's Revolutionary Wealth and Its Impact Around the World. And on the 22nd of May, we'll have a program on in support of Arab democracy, how and why, with Larry Diamond and Stephen Cook. Stephen Cook is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and project director of the Independent Task Force on Arab Reform. And Larry Diamond is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and professor of sociology and political science at Stanford. Tonight's program, we will have a microphone here, and I want to draw your attention to it. And for questions following Professor Frieden's talk, and in addition, you'll find question cards on your chairs. Feel free to use them if you'd like to write a question down, but he will be taking questions directly from the audience. And let me also take a moment to ask you all to please turn off your cell phones and anything else that goes beep for both the audience and the recording. Now, let me just take a moment to note that we are very pleased and fortunate tonight to be joined by Theda Scotchpole, Dean of the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University. And Dean Scotchpole will be introducing Professor Frieden. Let me say a few words about her. Everyone probably knows who she is, but let me just note that she also serves as Victor S. Thomas Professor of Government and Sociology and Director of the Center for American Political Studies, and has served as president of the Social Science History Association and the American Political Science Association. And as a student of her work on revolutions, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Dean Scotchpole, and she will introduce Professor Frieden. Thank you.
Thank you all. It's so nice to see everyone tonight, and I want to join in welcoming all of you. The Graduate School of Arts and Sciences, of which I have been dean for about 10 months now, is very proud to have initiated this event in partnership with the Harvard Club of San Francisco and the World Affairs Council. And it gives me special pleasure to be able to introduce my friend and colleague, Jeff Frieden. Jeff has informed me this evening that he is a Yankees fan.
I can't do that in Boston.
But I'm overcoming the feelings that well up in me as a native of Detroit and originally a fan of the Detroit Tigers and as a longtime fan of the Boston Red Sox to go on to forge ahead in introducing him tonight. Jeff Frieden is the Stanfield Professor of International Peace at Harvard University and specializes in the politics of international monetary and financial relations, which is why you're all here tonight to hear about that. He earned his BA and his PhD at another university other than Harvard University. It happens. And then when it happens, we try to bring them to Harvard University after they've proved themselves, which he did actually, spending quite a few years at the University of California at Los Angeles before he came to Harvard in 1995. He's the author of several major books. The first was Banking on the World, The Politics of American International Finance, then Debt, Development, and Democracy, Modern Political Economy in Latin America, 1965 to 1985, and finally, newly published, the book that we're going to hear about tonight, Global Capitalism, Its Rise, Its Fall and Rise in the 20th Century. And Jeff tells me that this book makes an ideal Mother's Day present. If you haven't already purchased it for your mom, I'm sure Amazon can deliver it on time. So it's my pleasure to introduce Jeffrey.
Well, thank you very much, Theda. It's a great pleasure to be here. I thank the World Affairs Council and the Harvard Club and GSAS for this invitation. It's really pleasant to be in San Francisco and to be able to talk to such an enthusiastic audience. I feel like I'm teaching a class because I hate people standing in the back. There are some empty seats up front, if you don't mind sitting up front, but if you want to sit in back, you can stay back there. Let me start by highlighting some trends which I think are relatively familiar, if I can bring this up. Okay. Yeah, Joshua. Where's Josh? You didn't touch it? Yeah, that's what I'm doing. Yep. Okay. Okay, there we go. Okay. I knew it would, sooner or later. So, let me start by highlighting some trends which I think are familiar. Over the last 50 and especially the last 25 years, there has been a continual increase in the integration of the global economy. It is commonplace to note, as this simple set of charts indicates, that the black line indicates that the movement of that goods has come to move more and more freely across borders. The red line indicates that capital has come to move more and more freely across borders. The red bars indicate that even people have begun to move more and more free, or continue to move more and more freely across borders. There has been a continual increase in all of these trends in the past 50 years, but especially in the past 25. One might point out that at least some part of this trend is perhaps in some small measure responsible for the current controversy over immigration in the United States. There is a very dramatic increase in the level, quantity of immigration into the United States over the past 50 years, and especially really in the past 25 years. But this is fairly well known. I think that most of us have come in the context of this broad and deep and continual integration of the global economy to think of this tying together of the world's economies as something which is on a continuing upward trend, that in a general sense it is, or at least has become, the natural and normal course of things and will continue for the foreseeable future. What I'd like to do, however, is to try to put this in some broader perspective and point to, if you will, a bigger picture or a longer view. Because in the bigger picture, we see something a little different, which is that, in fact, in a broader historical perspective, where we are today is roughly comparable to where we were about 100 years ago. That the world economy was just about as integrated on all the dimensions that I've talked about in the decades and even generations before 1914 as it is today. Whether in terms of capital, goods, people, information, transportation, on all of these dimensions, as you can see, before World War I, before 1914, the international economy was very tightly integrated. Talking about, in fact, on some dimensions, it was much more integrated than it is today. People moved much more freely in the years before 1914 than they do today. We go back to the picture of the dramatic increase in American immigration since the 1950s and 60s. In broader historical perspective, in fact, we are well below historic trends in the United States. Right? Trade today is roughly equivalent as a share of output to what it was in the decades before 1914. International investment is, although it's difficult to measure, probably below where it was in the decades before 1914. As an example, in those years, more than half of all British investment went overseas. Now, there is not a major country in the world that comes anywhere close to that. In fact, the nearest today is at less than one-third of that level. Right. So, in terms of capital flows, the world was tightly integrated. Over one half of all investment in many developing countries in the late 19th and early 20th century came from abroad. Immigration was, as I've said before, at a much higher level. Multinationals were more important to the major economies of the day than they are today, with the exception of the U.S., which was just finding its feet in, as an international investor. And again, in immigration terms, we are only barely starting to return to where we were many decades ago and in the years of the late 19th and early 20th century. In addition, and I'm going to now kill this, or try to kill the slides so that you can pay total attention to me. In addition, there was a global gold standard that tied all of the world's countries together in a common monetary order, something that we don't have today. By 1905 or 6, every significant country in the world was on gold, which meant that for all intents and purposes, they shared a common money. And although it's a little bit of an exaggeration to say so, you could travel from place to place and use the same money in every country in the world with the exception of Persia and China. So the world economy was tightly integrated in the decades before 1914. Economic integration was at a high level in ways which are very similar to today. Perhaps more important, on many, many dimensions, not all, but many, the system worked. It worked in a broad macroeconomic sense in that it was associated with the most rapid economic growth in all of previously recorded history. It worked in the sense that poor countries, on average, got richer, that the so-called middle-income countries of the day, in some cases, got rich. Countries like Argentina, Uruguay, Chile, Australia, Canada, which started off quite poor in the 1860s and 70s, had surpassed much of Europe by 1914. It was stable. There was very little volatility in international economic affairs in this period. And for all these reasons, despite the many tensions, despite the many problems, which I will come back to, the people of especially the advanced industrial countries in the late 19th and early 20th century could be forgiven, I think, for thinking that this was, in fact, the normal and natural state of affairs and that it would, indeed, last forever. And yet, this integrated global economy came crashing down in a matter of weeks in 1914. Now, 1914 was the start of World War I, and so after the war was over, international political and economic leaders argued, with some obvious support, that the problem was simply war, and that all that needed to be done was to make an effort to restore the global economic order that had reigned before World War I. In the aftermath of World War I, there was, in fact, a whole series of systematic attempts to restore the classical global economic order. Major attempts, serious attempts. There were treaties, conferences, international organizations, changes in policies, international institutions and associations. But nothing worked. For a decade or more, the world muddled through a series of continually failed attempts to restore the pre-1914 international economic order. And eventually, after 1929, it all collapsed into the Great Depression and eventually World War II. And the 20th century largely turned out to be a series of debates, intellectual, political, economic, ideological, over what had gone wrong and whether and how it could be fixed. So I want to step back for a moment, because there are so many similarities between the first era of globalization, if you will, and our contemporary period, to ask why this integrated global economy of the generations before World War I could not be restored. What was the problem? It wasn't technology. Technological advance in the interwar era was as rapid as it had ever been, in fact, probably more rapid than it had ever been. A number of massive advances in production and consumption technology, the automobile, the airplane, consumer durables like home appliances, moving pictures, long-distance telephony, the massification of electricity, all these things, the zipper, one of my favorite inventions, all these things were invented or became generally produced in the 1920s, along with the invention that has ever since been the benchmark against which all other inventions are measured, sliced bread in 1923. Organizationally, the modern corporation and the modern multinational corporation and modern international banking really go back to this period. So it wasn't technology. It wasn't economic growth, despite the fact that we tend to think of the interwar period as one of great stagnation because we think of the Great Depression. The 1920s, however, were a period of very rapid economic growth. In fact, so rapid, so unprecedentedly rapid, that in many countries they have their own name. The Roaring Twenties, the Baldwin Age, the Jazz Age, the Dance of the Millions in Latin America. Right? The 1920s were a period of rapid economic growth, not of slow growth. I think the problems were political. Now, on the one political aspect of the problems of the post-1914 era was international. It did not help in the attempts to reconstruct an integrated global economy that the U.S., after its involvement in World War I, withdrew. That it, in the isolationist era of the day, turned away from the League of Nations, turned away from international political involvement, and unlike Britain, France, Germany, and other countries, refused to get involved in attempts to restore a global economy, a globally integrated economy. It also didn't help that the principal belligerents of World War I continued to fight their war by economic means after 1918. That France and Germany, which had been two of the pillars of global economic cooperation before 1914, spent most of the subsequent 15 years trying to do each other in economically, as they had not been able to do on the battlefield. That didn't help. But I don't think that was even paramount. I think the political problems of the interwar period that made a restoration of the classical economic order impossible were largely domestic. That the economic and political bases of that classical era were gone. The foundation stone of the classical international economy was a general consensus on the priority of international commitments. That is, economic and political leaders of every major economy in those late 19th and early 20th century years agreed that commitment to international economic integration was first and foremost. Remember, we're not talking about everybody in these economies, in these polities. We're talking about those who ran them. They agreed that if adjustment was needed, it would be undertaken. If the economy had to adjust to maintain its international economic position, it would do so. And typically the way that it did so was by adjusting wages, that is, pushing them downward. Wages were flexible. In fact, the economies as a whole were flexible because economies were dominated by small farms, small firms, family farms, unorganized labor, and generally unorganized business. So when the necessities of global economic integration required, if you will, that wages, prices, profits be pushed down to maintain international competitiveness, to maintain the country's position in the world economy, it was done. It was possible economically, as I say, because these economies were, in economic terms, competitive. That is, they were dominated by small firms and farms and unorganized labor. It was also possible for political reasons, because most of the political systems of the major economies of the day were either not democratic at all or not fully democratic, or barely democratic. So it was relatively easy for the governments of the late 19th and early 20th century to ignore the political and, in some sense, the economic costs of the adjustment necessary to sustain international economic integration. By the 1920s, that was no longer true. It was not true economically, because by the interwar period, most of the major economies had come to be dominated not by small firms, but by major modern corporations. Not by atomistic laborers, but by large, well-organized labor unions supporting large, powerful socialist parties. So economically, wages and prices and profits were not so flexible as they had been in the late 19th and early 20th century. And even more important, the political representation of labor, of farmers, of the middle classes in new and expanded democracies meant that there was protest when wages and prices were attempted to be pushed downward, and there was a much broader set of demands for social insurance and social reform. Leaders and governments in the 20s and 30s could not simply wait for wages and prices to go down to right an economy in crisis. It was no longer economically feasible. It was no longer politically feasible. So in a way, the classical economic integration worked because the policies necessary to sustain these international commitments were both economically and politically feasible. And that classical order could not be rebuilt because these policies, by the 20s and 30s, were no longer economically or politically practical. The new economic and political realities of a modern society overwhelmed the classical order. Keynes's summary of this was to talk about how big business and big labor were not the main actors before 1914, but after World War I they were. And you could have small government when you did not have big labor and big business, but with big business and big labor, you needed big government. That was his synthesis of this era. Another way of thinking about it is in the first era of globalization, the political system did very well at reflecting and representing and responding to the beneficiaries of economic integration, the winners, so to speak. It was wholly inadequate to the task of reflecting or representing or responding to the concerns of those who were harmed or who thought they were harmed by the international economy. And that was sustainable as long as those who were harmed or thought they were harmed by the international economy were not politically represented with limited democracy. But it was disastrous in the modern, much more democratic societies of the 1920s and 30s. Let me give an example. There were lots of I idealized the pre-1914 international economy for effect, although I think some of the idealization is justified in historical perspective. There were, however, many, many tensions, many problems. Perhaps the most pressing and continual problem in the late 19th and early 20th century was that the rich countries, industrial countries, were flooded with cheap products coming in from rapidly growing countries in other parts of the world, threatening the livelihoods of millions of their residents. That was the principal problem that upset the politics of the industrial countries between the 1880s and World War I. Sounds a little familiar. The origin was different. The goods flooding into the industrial countries were farm goods, and they were coming from rapidly developing countries like Australia and Canada and Argentina and southern Brazil and the United States. And the people whose livelihoods were being threatened and in some cases destroyed by this flood of cheap products were European farmers. But it was no less dramatic for the difference in origin and the difference in effect. There was starvation and near starvation conditions in many parts of Europe, in southern Europe, in Scandinavia, in central and eastern Europe. How was it dealt with? How were the social tensions that this massive flood of cheap products putting millions and tens of millions of European farmers out of work dealt with? Essentially by ignoring it. Those who were affected emigrated, or they came to the cities, went to the European cities, or they starved. By the 1920s and 30s, where very similar trends were in train, it was not possible to ignore European farmers and others harmed by the international economy. And it is no coincidence, I think, that the principal mass base of European fascism was precisely the small farmers who had been ignored by the previous order and who had come to see the international economy as a threat, probably correctly. And so, the political economies of the 1920s and 30s were abject failures and spiraled down into depression, social conflict, civil war, trade wars, and eventually shooting wars. And there was a terrible backlash against the global integration of the pre-1914 period. In some sense, people accepted the intellectual precepts of the pre-1914 era. Classical globalism said that priority had to be given to the international economy, and that things like social reform, social policies, nation building had to take second place or be forgotten about altogether. They were nowhere near as important and, in fact, threatened the global economic order. Fine, said some of the opponents. We choose social reform, and if that means giving up the global economy, we'll do it, and we choose communism. Fine, said other opponents. We choose nation building, and if that means giving up the global economy, we'll do it, and we'll choose fascism or economic nationalism in the developing world. And in fact, if you had looked around the world in the mid and late 1930s, what appeared to be happening was the continual, inexorable, successful march of political and economic movements that were diametrically opposed to and fundamentally denied the desirability of international economic integration. Fascism, communism, economic nationalism. These were the success stories of the interwar period. They were, in some sense, overwhelming the world. There was, of course, a fringe of Western Europe and North America, Australia, New Zealand, in which an alternative very slowly, very gradually developed. An alternative that I call, and scholars typically call, social democracy, not for any partisan reason, but simply because it seems to capture the idea that came to be widely shared in the Western democracies, North America in this period. That is, that it was possible, in fact desirable, to have a democratic society based on the market, which still had substantial and generous social insurance programs. And it seemed to capture something inherent in modern capitalism, a compromise, if you will, between big business and big labor in a democratic setting. That was seemed to be the alternative, but it was very weak, embryonic, even by the late 1930s. In some sense, World War II was, to some extent, a battle between the countries of the West, at least, which had opted for this social democratic alternative, and the countries of Central and Eastern Europe and Japan, who had opted for economic nationalism, fascism. And the victory of the West, at least, in World War II, was associated with an international expansion of this kind of compromise. The so-called Bretton Woods system that was erected by the United States and its allies in the aftermath of World War II was, like social democracy, a sort of a middle road. It was committed to economic integration, and it was committed to social reform and social programs. It was committed to encouraging trade, but doing so gradually, leaving agriculture out, for example, allowing countries to erect trade barriers if they felt they needed to. It was in favor of encouraging international investment, but allowing countries to impose controls on capital movements if they felt they needed to. It was a compromise. So under the Bretton Woods system, economic integration was gradual and partial. Trade liberalization went forward, but slowly. International investment increased, but slowly. Economic openness developed gradually, in moderation, and in association with an expansion of the welfare state. It seemed to be, and in fact it was, a very successful compromise. The Western economies became very closely tied together and experienced once again their fastest and most stable growth in history. But, and I'm going to fast forward through, failure is always more exciting than success, I suppose, fast forward through this, also because I want to leave enough time for some discussion. After 25 years of the Bretton Woods system, problems began to arise. To some extent, these problems were a result of the success of the compromise that had emerged. Within the Bretton Woods Compromise, there was a gradual increase in international investment, international trade, integration of economies. And so the compromise led to a greater and greater integration of national economies, which began to erode some of the deals that had been struck in the interwar period and in the immediate post-war era. So in ways that I can talk about if people are interested afterwards, this most successful system broke down, starting with the International Monetary Order, but soon all of its components seemed under threat. And though it's hard to remember, perhaps, for some of us, what it looked like in the 70s and into the early 80s. There were real questions in the 70s and early 80s as to whether the world was going to move back towards more economic nationalism, more closure, more tight-knit, exclusive regional economic zones, or forward towards greater and greater global economic integration. By the mid to late 80s, that battle was over, and the issue seemed to be effectively resolved. First, in the developed countries, where by the mid to late 80s, the predominance of a commitment to globalization, if you will, was general. Then, by the late 80s, in the developing world, where in a very striking reversal, countries that had for decades and decades since independence cut themselves off from international trade and international finance, reversed course and opened themselves to the world economy. And most strikingly, after 1990-91, by the mid-1990s, the communist countries, essentially planned economies, threw themselves with varying degrees of enthusiasm into the global capitalist order. And we were brought back, if you will, to globalization. However, in my view, the underlying issue has not truly been resolved and harkens back to that of a century ago. As was true, in my view, 100 years ago, global economic integration now provides enormous benefits. But it also imposes some very severe costs. The sorry experience of the interwar period showed that the discontent of those who are harmed by international competition, by exposure to the international economy, can quickly and stunningly overcome the support of those who benefit by it. So today, once again, the benefits of global integration are palpable and widely enjoyed. But the costs, too, can be serious. Costs for regions, costs for industries, costs for countries as a whole. Today, fortunately, as was true in the 1920s and 30s, representative democracy is the norm, not universal, but is the norm in many countries. And so the tensions that did in the classical economy in the 20s and 30s are still present. Now, the prevailing view, I think, at least the one that I find to be prevailing, is to rely upon persuasion. That is, to try to convince people of the long-term benefits of globalization, the long-term benefits of an integrated international economy, or of its centrality to national security, or of some other longer-term goal that justifies sacrifice in the interest of sustaining an integrated economic order. But in my opinion, that will not work, because there are real and concrete and very accurately perceived, perhaps short-term, but accurately perceived interests at stake. There are people who are being harmed by the integrated global economy, and no amount of persuasion is going to convince them to act against their interests, at least in the short run. So, I'm going to try to finish so that we can leave time for discussion. There are many other aspects of the contemporary era that we could talk about and contemporary problems. But what I want to emphasize is that I think we can, in fact, learn some lessons from the past century, especially lessons from the experience of the first era of global capitalism, how it fell and how it rose again. In the aftermath of this previous era of globalization, economic and political leaders attempted to ignore the costs of economic integration. And that attempt to ignore them led to a terrible and justifiable or at least understandable backlash. So attempts on the part of leaders of the Western world to ignore the costs failed. Attempts on the part of those who were engaged in the backlash to ignore the benefits of the previous system, I think, led to terrible policies and also to failure. The alternatives to global economic integration were tried all over the world for decades and, I think, found wanting. There are no easy answers, but it seems to me that this is, once again, the world's central issue. The core problem of the 20th century was whether and how to restore an integrated international economy, which the world had known for several generations before then. The core problem today, I think, will be, perhaps already is, how to build and sustain an international political and economic order, and domestic political and economic orders, that do two things at once. On the one hand, that allow societies to reap the fruits of the global economy, while on the other hand, maintaining the social and political stability necessary for economies to thrive. Let me stop there and throw the floor open for questions. Sure, there's a microphone there if you feel the need to use it.
Perhaps you'd like to comment on something, a meeting that occurred in Washington, D.C., just a couple of days ago that I happened to see on CNN concerning the matter of immigration. And what was so interesting was that the foreign ministers of eight Latin American countries were hosted by the Inter-American Council in Washington, D.C., and they all made a series of statements concerning immigration policy within the United States. And essentially, what they attempted to do was to thread the needle between asserting their own national interests on behalf of their citizens who had migrated to the United States and were sending remittances back home, and their desire to recognize the sovereignty of the United States over its own immigration policy and borders. And I don't know if I'd be interested in your perspective on that development and what it might mean in terms of your lecture.
Well, I mean, there are many, many aspects of immigration policy, many of which are domestic and political in the U.S., of course, but I think what you're asking about is how it implicates or is related to relations between the U.S. and Latin America. And it is a very touchy subject for, in some sense, for the United States. It's touchy on both sides, but it's touchy for the United States, like many other subjects, because the United States has been arguing that Latin America should open itself to the international economy and be willing to accept technologies, cultures, economic affairs, political influence from the rest of the world while maintaining what most Latin Americans think of as a very closed system with respect to immigration. So the U.S. faces something of a conundrum. By the same token, Latin Americans face a problem because, as you say, some countries, not all of them, but some, have become very dependent upon remittances from immigrants to the United States, which in some sense could be regarded as a failure of the national economy. If El Salvador is relying for its principal source of income on what Salvadorans can earn in the United States, there's something wrong with the Salvadoran economy. So I think that there are, this is a very, very thorny issue. I think that in both instances, both in Latin America and the U.S., what can be done is largely constrained by what is possible on the domestic political front. From an inter-American perspective, perhaps deals could be cut, arrangements could be worked out. But I think in both instances, those arrangements face very serious domestic obstacles. Let me give you another example. It may seem like changing the subject, but in some sense it is, but it's analogous, which is trade policy. Right. Latin America, starting in the mid-1980s, began very systematically and very dramatically opening its trade policies to the point where there are some Latin American countries which have among the lowest tariffs in the world and certainly lower tariffs than the U.S. Tariffs, if you take into account all the trade barriers that the United States has. So Latin America has really fairly consistently and systematically thrown itself enthusiastically into free trade. And they look north, and what they see is that every time Latin America succeeds in producing goods competitively at low cost, the U.S. imposes trade barriers, starting with farm goods, but also in textiles, garments, footwear, luggage, and all sorts of other things. And so the Latin Americans, I think, with some obvious, justice, say, if we're liberalizing trade, the least you can do is not protect against our exports, and the U.S. says, yes, in principle, we're in favor of that, but you understand we have these domestic political problems and so on and so forth, and the Latin Americans say, we've been telling you for 20 years about our domestic political problems. You said they didn't matter. We should just do it anyway, so what's the problem? So I guess the point is that, as in so much else, it's easy to talk about how economic ties could or should be developed more cooperatively, how arrangements could be more cooperative. In every instance, I think, what stands in the, I hate to say stands in the way because it sounds judgmental, but the real question is, how do you work on the domestic political front to make those international economic agreements feasible and possible? And that goes back, in some sense, to the general point that I was trying to make, is the U.S. could say, okay, we're going to liberalize our immigration policy, and that would certainly dramatically improve our relations with Latin America with respect to immigration, at least. But it would have costs in the U.S. And we can argue about what those costs might be. It have benefits as well, but it would have costs in the U.S. To do that without attending to what those costs might be, I think, is to make the kinds of mistakes that were so disastrous in the 20s and 30s. So I guess I would end up by saying this is an example of how international economic cooperation cannot ignore the domestic political implications of that.
Thank you.
I'd like to throw out four economic facts that have you respond in terms of your general at worldview here. Number one, global economic imbalances right now are intractable, with the U.S. running a 7% current account deficit. And there's no automatic adjustment mechanism as there was under the gold standard or even Bretton Woods, original Bretton Woods. And as you probably know, some economists call this Bretton Woods too, but that's not really right. Second fact, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, real weekly earnings in the U.S. have declined 17% since 1972, i.e. since the end of Bretton Woods I. Third fact, the front page of the Financial Times today had an article that said that non-performing loans in China could be more than double what people had thought they were, on the order of $800 to $900 billion, according to a new study, which goes to the issue of financial and corporate governance in that company. And number four, the end of the era of cheap energy, which underpinned a lot of the positive things that happened in the post-war era.
Well, those are, in fact, all facts, I think. I'm not quite sure how to weave them together into the tapestry of an answer. Let me start with your second fact, because I think it's the one that's in some sense, I hope it's the one that's most structural, and that is the dramatic decline over the past 30 years in the real wages of unskilled American workers. That's, if you decompose the trend that you talk about, it's really about unskilled workers. And the real wages of unskilled Americans have declined not only in relative terms, but in absolute terms since 1973. There was a brief respite in the 90s, but they've started to decline again. There is a lot of debate over what causes this, whether it is the result of international trade or the result of technological change. I think the consensus view, which means the one that I agree with, is that it's a combination of the two. Richard Freeman in the economics department at Harvard has a well-known article whose title is "Are Your Wages Set in Beijing?" And the general point about globalization and real wages of unskilled American workers is that by integrating the U.S. with the rest of the world, and especially with low-wage countries like China or Mexico, what you've done is thrown American workers, and unskilled workers especially, in direct competition with Chinese or Vietnamese or Mexican workers. And I think there is little doubt that that will tend to depress the wages of unskilled Americans. So that is an example of the kinds of costs that I was talking about before. I believe, although again there's controversy, I believe that there is no question that the worsening of the American income distribution, and especially the decline of both the relative and absolute wages of the bottom third or so, are related to the increased integration of the U.S. into the world economy. Now, we can ignore that, which is largely what's been done, and say that's the price we pay. But look how many people are getting rich as a result. Look how well other parts of the country are doing. Look how well other segments of the economy are doing. And that's not what I would suggest. In fact, what I would suggest is that the only way in the medium and long run to ensure the political sustainability of our integration into the world economy is to deal with the fact that unskilled wages have declined continually. And this is a very serious problem. The global imbalances, the China question, I'm going to try to gloss that over simply because it would take us too far down. If someone else asks about it, I will talk about China, which the question you're asking of non-performing loans is very closely related to the question of the renminbi, of the value of the Chinese currency vis-a-vis the U.S. dollar. And the U.S.-China trade relationship is in some sense, central to a lot of what's going on in the world today. In fact, it's central to the second fact that I was going to address, which is global imbalances, because the Chinese have been financing many of these global imbalances. American policy for the last 5 or 6 years has been governed by the willingness and the ability of the rest of the world to lend between $400 and $700 billion a year to the United States. And that has financed a massive consumption boom in the U.S., which is not based on an expansion of investment or savings, but based on our access to the savings of the rest of the world. Right? Americans are, to a certain extent, living as well as we are because we are borrowing against the future. And that's where the global imbalances come from. They originate, in my view, with American fiscal policy, with fiscal deficits driven by whatever you think they're driven by, a combination of tax cuts and spending increases in Iraq and things like that, and reliance on foreign borrowing to finance that, which then tends to drive up the dollar, which leads to the trade deficits and so on and so forth. That is not sustainable. The current global imbalances are not sustainable. Bretton Woods II or not, Mike Darby or not. And eventually, as is always the case, countries like the United States, that borrow to sustain their consumption and are able to consume beyond their means, will eventually have to service their debts, which means they'll have to generate a surplus, that is reduced consumption, to pay back foreigners. And that will require substantial austerity and substantial sacrifice. Now, it's in the future. And it is unfortunate that the American political system seems incapable of doing the numbers between the present and the future. But I think there is little doubt that the current global imbalances, which are making our lives much pleasanter and much easier now, will make our lives much less pleasant and much harder in the future. And they contain within them at least the possibility of creating the kinds of social and political tensions that were unfortunately familiar 70, 80, 90 years ago. Now, that may sound dire, but the fact is that the U.S. is going to face the choice of whether to dramatically, and I mean very dramatically, cut back on things like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, social programs, or dramatically, and I mean dramatically, increase taxes in order to cover what is now a $5 or $6 trillion foreign debt. There is no way out of that. Right? One way or the other, we're going to have to pay that either in inflation or in real money. And the costs will be borne, not by everyone, by some groups in society, and there will be conflict over it. So I think that, I see that in the medium and long term as one of the greatest threats. And I see it not as a threat. The global imbalances sounds like, you know, typical econo-speak, right? The global imbalances are sort of vague in general. I see the danger of the global imbalances in the demands that they put on national politics and national political economies, first and foremost, the American political economy and American politics, to re-equilibrate those imbalances. So I'll stop with those two because I would take another.
What about the end of
the year of cheap energy? I'll try to come back to that. I'll stick around afterwards and we can talk about it, but there are other people who I'm would sorry. Like to. That's all right. In other words, I don't know.
I will say that probably should have been the culminating point in your comments to give us all a great deal to think about. But in connection with globalization, it has been associated with a number of different things. One is certainly free markets and relatively free capital movements, all sort of tied with the economic theory of comparative advantage. It also has been associated with what you had termed as representative democracy. I'd like your comment on, first of all, whether it does need both of those. We certainly see in the connection with China, as you started to address, that's not what we would identify as a representative democracy and may or may not be coming such. But more importantly, I'd like you to address whether globalization is anything other than a threat to the structure that we have defined and seem to hold sacred, that is always defined around something called nation states.
Well, you ask about two things, about the relationship between globalization and two things. The first is representative democracy, and the second is the nation state. With respect to representative democracy, I think that there's no necessary connection between the two. I think the late 19th and early 20th century showed, and China shows, and other countries show, that you can be fully integrated into the world economy and not be democratic. I think that fortunately, most of the countries that are currently, at least the advanced industrial countries, and many, many developing countries that are currently tightly integrated into the world economy are democratic, and that is a good thing. But that does raise a set of problems different from those of dictatorships that are economically integrated. So I don't see those as being tightly linked. There's not a direct causal relationship. Democracy doesn't cause globalization. Globalization doesn't cause democracy. They're running on, to some extent, on separate tracks, although there are interactions between the two. Where the more direct connection is what you were raising about the nation state. And I think whether globalization is consistent with or compatible with our traditional notions of the nation state depends on what you mean by those notions of nationality or nationalism or the nation state. Globalization, by definition, means that markets are no longer primarily national. But lots of other things are. Language, culture, education. In fact, to some extent, when I try to think about the future, I often use the experience of Europe as, to some extent, the harbinger of the future, because the members of the European Union have gone farther than any other region in integrating their economies, to the extent that the 15 and now 25 members, but certainly the 15, are more tightly integrated than the U.S. is on many dimensions. There's a single market for goods, a single market for capital, a single market for labor, there's a common currency, and they're actually single common regulators, which we don't have since we have 50 states regulating lots of things. So the EU, the European Union, has gone very far in that direction, and I don't think there's a lot of evidence that nationalism or national sovereignty, or it depends how you define sovereignty, but the ability to do things differently at a national and local level has decreased. And in fact, in some sense, it may have increased. The European integration has been associated with the resurgence of certain kinds of nationalisms in Europe. Basque, Catalan, Galician, regions of the countries of Europe that were in some sense subordinated behind or in as part of the attempt to build a Spanish national market or a French national concept or an Italian, have now been allowed to flourish because the economic component of nation building is no longer predominant. So I guess I'm more optimistic than you seem to be that economic integration is compatible with the maintenance of popular sovereignty over a lot of other things that are also important.
Thank you.
Professor, I'd like to go back to the concept of the global imbalances, the trade imbalances, and I really got two questions for you. One is a pretty short one and then a little bit of a longer question. Are you brave enough? You say the global imbalances, at least from the U.S. perspective, are not sustainable, number one, and number two, they're going to end badly. Are you brave enough, if you will, to try to put any kind of a time frame on that?
You know the saying, give them a date or give them a number, but never both at the same time. I'm much better at forecasting the past than the future, so I think I'll stick with that. I think, the fact, I'll let you ask your second question. So I think I think it's very difficult to really think through a reasonable forecast. And those that say they have one, I don't believe, because it's closely related, for example, to what happens in East Asia with China, Vietnam, Southeast Asia more generally. The global imbalances at this point are sustainable because we are able to rely on massive surpluses on the part of the Chinese and increasingly the Vietnamese and other countries in East Asia. So not to speak of what's happening in Europe. And so there are too many unknowns, I think, to establish a serious attempt to build a timeline.
Second question.
Yes.
A couple years ago, Warren Buffett came out with a proposal. The proposal was written up in I think it was Fortune magazine. And basically, if I can try to summarize the concept, it was that American exporters, by virtue of exporting product, would earn an entitlement that then could be traded in the free market that they could either use themselves or sell to another firm that would allow that other firm to import material. So it's a little bit like the trading of greenhouse gases. It would put a premium or a dollar return in addition to simply the export activity on export value and try to balance the economics between the economics of exporting versus the economics of importing. It was written up and received a fair amount of attention. Like I said, I think it was about 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. Are you familiar with that? And any reaction to it?
I remember the proposal, and there have been other proposals along similar lines. All of this comes from the same concern about global imbalances.
Right.
What people are really concerned about in the U.S. is that we just don't seem to be able to export enough to pay for our imports. And so there have been a variety of attempts to suggest ways of encouraging exports. One is to subsidize them directly or indirectly. Another is to give tax breaks to exporters. A third is to allow export processing zones, which are less regulated and things like that. I tend to take, perhaps it's my background, a more macroeconomic view, which is that it's not really the inability of American workers or American businessmen to produce competitively that's the problem. It's the dollar. The reason the U.S. can't sell its goods in the rest of the world is that the dollar is too strong. And it's too strong because we have to have interest rates high enough. We have to attract $700 billion in foreign purchases of American securities. So every time that someone buys $1 billion of American bonds, he's buying dollars, and that drives the demand for the dollar up. So the American fiscal deficit drives the dollar up, just as it did under Reagan between 81 and 85. So the underlying problem with American exports, in my view, is not the tax system or export processing zones or anything like that. The underlying problem is the imbalances, fiscal policy, and the dollar.
Thank you.
Hello. What do you feel are the political steps that can be taken on an international level to shore up the world economy and prevent the problems you foresee? And can those institutions be achieved if one region of the world decides not to participate in it or, God forbid, retracts from the global economy? Will the whole thing come crashing down?
Right. Well, I think that it's easier to, well, it's relatively easy in a technical sense to say what could be done to increase the ability of national leaders to deal with these international economic imbalances, for example. I think the real problems are, as I was saying before, at the domestic level, because the international initiatives are, to the extent that they get anywhere, typically hamstrung, like trade reform, hamstrung by domestic obstacles. So the international trading system and international trade negotiations are at a halt. They've been at a halt for a couple of years now, and they show absolutely no signs of going anywhere. And it's not because of a failure of some international bargaining forum, and it's not because of a failure of imagination among international leaders. It's because the domestic political situation in the U.S. and in Europe doesn't allow these negotiations to move forward. So I think the real obstacles are not at the international level so much as they are at the domestic political level. So that's one thing, one part of the answer. The second question that you asked was about whether things could move forward in the absence of one major region. It would depend on the region, I suppose. But the basic answer would be yes, I think, that if the U.S. and the Europeans, for example, work together, that would certainly be better than not working together, even if it were absent the cooperation of the Japanese or the Japanese and the Chinese. I think that's unlikely, though. I think we don't appear to be heading towards a situation. We may be heading towards a situation of regionalization in the sense of the Western Hemisphere as a more self-contained region, Europe and its surrounding areas more self-contained. But I don't think we seem to be heading towards two out of the three big regions being on their own. That's my.
Just as an aside, Professor, I don't know where you get the idea that the dollar is too strong. About three, what's that?
Go on. You're the last question.
Oh.
Oh.
Okay.
About 3 years ago, I was in Europe and I paid for the euro 78 or 86 cents US. I'm going to Europe next week, and I'll have to pay $1.26. That's a de facto devaluation of more than 50%. And if we look at oil prices and realize that oil is denominated in dollars, it's not so surprising that we are paying more in dollars for oil. Europe is not feeling that shock as much. That's just as an aside.
Sure.
You made a comparison between the world at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, and now. And the French have a saying, plus ça change, the more it changes, the more it remains the same. What we saw in 20th century, was a few nations in the world, handful, maybe 40, 50, that really ran the world, and a lot of countries that were being colonized by these nations. We, at the same time, the capital was in the hands of a few, and a multitude of people in these rich countries were not benefiting. Now we get a similar situation, except it's now macroeconomic in the sense that it's the world. We have a situation where so many more countries have entered the world, and compare those with the poor people in Europe in at the end of the 19th century, the 20th century, and you have a few rich countries. Now, the Western world resolved its problems with capitalism in that it had social democracies. As a matter of fact, we shared it somehow, and as a result, these countries now are more balanced. I mean, the European countries and the United States. The only answer is that we look at the world in the same manner, in that we share the wealth. And I think that's ultimately the answer for whatever problems we have. And you touched on the European Union, and that's a good example, because when Spain and Portugal and Greece and Ireland entered the European Union, they were poor, dismally poor. And from Brussels, the subsidies helped these countries on their legs, and now they're no longer as poor as they were then. As a matter of fact, Ireland now actually is better doing than the average. So that's the answer, I would say.
Okay, well, very briefly on the dollar. I mean, the fluctuations of the dollar against the euro from year to year, of course, are dramatic and perhaps worrisome for someone traveling to Europe. But overall, the value of the dollar, most economic analysis indicates that the dollar is being driven up by our fiscal deficits, which is why we have the big trade deficits we do in the medium and longer run. But I think your main point is one that I agree with in a very general sense, which is the principal inequality in the world, that is the internal inequality within the U.S., is as nothing compared to the inequality among nations. Right? To the extent that the world economy is characterized by great inequalities, which it is, these are inequalities that are largely explicable because there are many, many very poor countries. And my view is, and it is not a universally held view, that is that one of the best ways of setting the world and these countries on the path of improving their economic standing is by their participating in global markets, giving them access to the capital and technology and the markets of the rich world. In fact, Europe is a great example. It wasn't really the subsidies that let Portugal and Spain and Ireland grow as rapidly as they did. Ireland is one of the great success stories of post-World War II economic development. It went from half of British per capita income to much more than 20% above British per capita income, richer than its former colonizer, in the space of 35 years. And it wasn't the subsidies. It was access to the European market. It was the fact that the Irish were extraordinarily successful, as the Portuguese and the Spaniards and others, extraordinarily successful at taking advantage of capital and markets
in Europe. And there are many, many countries in the developing world that would like to do something similar, that would like to be able to take advantage of what the world economy has to offer. So I think that we could design very well-meaning, wonderful plans for redistributing wealth at the international level. And I guess my view of it would be like Gandhi's on Western civilization. It would be a good thing. But it's not feasible. And in fact, redistributing the currently existing wealth would not have much effect. The real answer is in more rapid, more economic growth in the poor countries of the world. The great hope for that, I think, is to continue a functioning, integrated world economy. The people who would suffer the most if the world economy went back to the bad old days of the 1920s and 30s are people in the developing world, I think. And so that, to me, reinforces the importance of trying to find a way to maintain a well-functioning international economy. I'll stop there. Thank you all for coming.